Welcome to the MacGuffin Man. I'm Alex, and with me, as usual, is James. You can check out our website, themacguffinman.com, to keep up on our most recent episodes. We talked about Little Women last week. Before that was Parasite, and before that was Uncut Gems. All right, here we are. Talking about another movie.
Yes. Talking about Phantom Thread.
Yes. Keeping in our point, because we love dress movies so much. After after the costume design of Little Women, we were like, we need another one. We're not done.
Stay tuned for 27 dresses. not true. We're talking about Phantom Thread, and as you pointed out, one of the only Paul Thomas Anderson movies we haven't talked about yet.
I don't know. We definitely didn't do a whole podcast on Heart 8, but I would assume that we've talked about that one at some point. So this would be the only one we haven't talked about.
Yes, and in his most recent, and if he's to be believed, Daniel Day-Lewis's final film.
Yes.
Do you not believe that?
I mean, I don't know him. It's so funny to me that he just declared retirement. Just like, don't act anymore. Like, what's the difference? He already disappears to a cave in between movies. It's just like, and nobody knows how to get in touch with him. So he's basically retired until he comes out of the cave and says, yes, I shall act again. You know?
Yeah, so. I guess that's true. Yeah. But yeah, they've Paul Thomas Anderson and Daniel Day-Lewis have obviously collaborated before.
Prove it. But yes, there will be blood, obviously.
Yeah, and this is... it's an interesting film to talk about when comparing it to There Will Be Blood, and I don't know, to me this feels a lot like The Master came up in my mind a lot too, and another Paul Thomas Anderson film. Mm-hmm. Yeah, where do you want to start with this one?
I don't know, it's tough. So yes, I agree that The Master comes up a lot in my mind in that, I mean, The Master is one of my favorite movies ever, potentially my favorite movie made when I've been an adult, you know, like that I was able to be there for opening day. And Paul Thomas, PTA's like last three movies, those two and Inherent Vice are very, like, they feel very like almost a different part of a career than the person that built up to There Will Be Blood, right? It's like, I kind of viewed There Will Be Blood as the sort of middle point between two different distinct phases of PTA's career. And we talked about this in detail in the Punch Drunk Love podcast. So I won't get too into it, but like, it's when he stopped being like really into the zooming Steadicam shots and more just into like hanging out with actors. And, it's resulted in, I think, three really good movies. I think of those three, Phantom Thread is my least favorite, but that's pretty much only because The Master is like a movie specifically designed to entertain somebody like me, entertain and flummox in a very particular enjoyable sort of way. And same with Inherent Vice. Those are just movies that are just so directed at my interests. And then this seems to be more, Phantom Thread seems to be more popular in general. I think it feels somehow more accessible, I guess. But still, it's still plenty weird. And yeah, I don't know. It's kind of a weird movie to figure out how to talk about it, because we use the obvious intro, Paul Thomas Anderson and Daniel Day-Lewis working together again. But I think something that should be mentioned early on is the collaborative way that this movie came together. Like, I'm sure you read a little bit about how PTA came up with the general idea, and then from a very early stage was involving Daniel Day-Lewis in the screenwriting process. And, you know, you sort of wrote the first 25 pages, sent it to Daniel Day-Lewis, who didn't really respond, and then wrote a little bit more. And then about the halfway point, PTA says they started to do like a real proper collaboration, like back and forth. And I think that's sort of an interesting place to start with this movie that is so much about the individual genius, you know, that is Reynolds Woodcock.
Yeah, and another sort of collaborative element of this, to my understanding, is that their cinematographer was sort of late in saying that they wouldn't be able to do it. So it seemed like a collaboration between Paul Thomas Anderson and, you know, other people who would just be operating a camera or doing lighting. It seemed like it was a collaborative effort there. So, yes. I mean, that's kind of your department. So maybe you could speak more to that. But it is, I think you're right that it is a good way to start, because the themes we're going to hit on, I assume, about this movie is that it's about extreme levels of control. It's about an artist wanting to do things particularly their way, to have it, to have their work appreciated in a very specific way. You know, we see someone have their dress confiscated because they don't deserve to be dressed in the House of Woodcock. Mm-hmm. This is a movie about being very particular about how you create your art, being very particular about how you, you know, function in a relationship. It very much is sort of this, I mean, I guess we can talk, it changes by the end somewhat, but it's very much about this top-down authoritarian way to create art and to function socially. And I think you're right that it is very interesting that this seems like some of the more collaborative filmmaking that Paul Thomas Anderson has done. And now he's not someone that we think of as these really, you know, control freak, domineering kind of people, directors.
I read about how he was talked about in the 90s.
Well, yeah.
You know, 90s, early 2000s, but yeah.
Yeah, that's what I mean at that point. And Obviously you don't get to be a director of his stature without having very particular ideas and being sort of unwavering to make sure they come out in your vision. But it does seem that it swings this way for a pretty interesting project.
Yeah, for sure. And I think the even the other side of that is, you know, you look at the Daniel Day-Lewis side of things, like he's also viewed as like the singular genius as well, you know, and the idea that they would work together to come up with a movie about another person viewed as a singular genius and almost sort of like poking holes in that idea, I think is really interesting. And you mentioned the camera department of this movie. It's Robert Elswit is Paul Thomas Anderson's usual cinematographer and wasn't available. I mean, he didn't shoot The Master, but I think he shot every other PTA movie. And Paul Thomas Anderson works with the same crew in general, with the exception of Elswit, when they're just doing their like Radiohead music videos and Haim videos. So it was basically his gaffer and his camera operator, and it's probably his assistant director, like just sort of working together. And the gaffer was the person with the light meter who would sort of measure out certain things, and then Paul Thomas Anderson would choose the lens, and then usually after the first couple takes, somebody else's lens suggestion would be listened to. The framing was Anderson got final decision on that. I mean, I assume he got final decision on everything, but he just sort of trusted his gaffer. And you see the lighting cameraman credit for Michael Bauman at the end of the movie, which is an old Kubrick staple. I think John Alcott is the only one I can think of did the Barry Lyndon, because Kubrick kind of did the same sort of thing. I just think it's interesting to view Paul Thomas Anderson as somebody who was talked about in such a specific, like as this sort of genius who came out of the womb, like directing perfect films, you know, and he was a part of that 1990s class that we've talked so much about, so I won't talk too much about, but the this collection of American geniuses that came of age in their 20s in the 1990s, and all of whom are singular geniuses who need no help whatsoever. And I think he played into that for a little bit, and I think he somewhere around 2010 or maybe after The Master, he sort of started caring more about not being seen that way. I think he just sort of wanted to be seen more as a person, and you can really see with Inherent Vice, part of this is just his lead actors not wanting to do press. I realize that, but with Joaquin Phoenix and Daniel Day-Lewis, he keeps casting actors who seem to refuse to do press, to the point where they had to write a scene into Phantom Thread to get Daniel Day-Lewis to pose for a photo for the poster, you know, like, and it's around Inherent Vice, Paul Thomas Anderson really starts pushing his own movies. And I think part of that is him wanting to be seen as a human being, as opposed to a guy who sits in the back shed of his house or whatever and just writes these works of perfection by himself, you know? Yeah. And I don't know. I find that interesting. And that's just something you don't see with a lot of filmmakers. You know, they either are people who at the beginning of their career will talk in every microphone that somebody points at them. I think Soderbergh is a good example of that. Or somebody who just tries to not talk to anybody at any point. I guess Christopher Nolan's the one that's coming to mind there. You know, it's like rarely do you see a director of this level kind of change their stance with time on giving long form interviews.
Yeah.
And I think it's specifically because he wants the other people in his crew to, or he wants to be seen as a human being. And also that's the only time anybody else in his crew is going to get the credit they deserve is when he specifically gives it to them, you know, because that's just how we talk about films. We talk about the director because it's the easiest way to talk about it. And then the gaffer's work is always credited to the director and every other person on the crew.
Yeah. No, I get you.
So, and I think the through line to Reynolds is, we don't see Reynolds do much in this movie other than sketch and approve things, you know, like as far as the work that we see Reynolds do. And I guess he stitches a couple, like his little individual, each dress is equivalent of the lock of his mother's hair into the garment, you know, like the never cursed piece of fabric. But aside from that, we see him do his sketches. We see him eat breakfast, and we see him approve dresses, you know? And the idea is that there's all these other, specifically in this case, women who are just doing the physical labor for him. You know, it's just like he comes up with the ideas and then they go off and do it. And he says yay or nay at the end of it. And even Cyril, who's Leslie Manville's character, his older sister, seems like not necessarily more important, but more important to the day-to-day existence of the House of Woodcock, not necessarily keeping it in existence fully, because if this movie is to be believed and Reynolds designs incredible dresses, I'm in no place to judge. He's the most important player in this, just because I think the design is the most important part of these incredibly fancy dresses. But this operation cannot run without Cyril, and it can't run with all the other women who are actually physically making these dresses.
Yeah, we're made to understand that he's capable of doing every part of the dressmaking, and he's based on Woodcock is based on a particular designer who also had that fame of, you know, a lot of designers like him would be able to sketch and that's about it, and then kind of, you know, not outsource it, but have somebody else do the sewing and all the more complicated things that I can't talk about because I know nothing about dressmaking.
Yeah, exactly.
But all the other, as you said, kind of more hands-on stuff. But you're right, we don't see that. And I think it's important that as you pointed out, he does sketching and he eats. You know, he does very essential things in this movie. And I think that that's part of the focus we're supposed to get from this character. We don't get a lot of him doing things that are absolutely essential to his business functioning or him staying alive. You know, there's a few food scenes, which I think are very important. Mm-hmm. And there's, as you said, there's him sketching. There's him taking measurements so that he can sketch. There are a few moments of him doing things that aren't entirely work-related, but His wedding and his honeymoon are in this film brief, not really enjoyed by him very much. Yeah. It seems, you know, they seem like something he's doing because he wants the end goal of being with Alma, but there's not much to it. And even his first dinner scene where he meets Alma for the first time, he's eating, you know, he's doing something essential to stay alive. And that scene and the other meal scenes are mostly him still in the mindset of work. You know, he sees Alma as a as the next model, and he does fall in love with her, but it does always seem as though he's looking at life through this lens. Even when he's doing something essential to human existence like eating, he never seems to get far away from his one kind of singular focus of being someone who makes dresses.
Yeah, that's true. And I mean, it's worth noting he does a lot of sketching at the breakfast table. It's pretty, it seems like even when he comes down to dinner with for the asparagus dinner with the with his fantastic dinner attire, the he brings a notebook with him. I know he's kind of making a point and wants to be a dick in that scene, but you know, like, I think with the exception of that first dinner with Alma, I don't know that there's ever a meal where we see him without a notebook, you know, maybe the porridge breakfast as well. I can't picture it there, but he's always working on something, even as he's doing these essential things, as you put it, as far as consuming food to stay alive, you know?
Yeah. And it seems that he's going to the country, you know, where the restaurant where he meets Alma, it seems like that is his chance to get away from work, you know. That's very specifically not work time. Mm. And so maybe that's why he doesn't have his book, but you can see that he's really just not able to turn it off, and he sees her figure, and he sees, you know, something/someone to put a dress on, and he never really turns away from sort of his vocation.
Yeah, exactly. And it's later that night when he first measures her for a dress, you know. So you're exactly right there, you know. It's pretty hard to give him any credit as somebody who's able to separate his attraction to Alma from just seeing a human body who he likes that would fit his dresses or his type of dresses. I don't know. I'm talking about dresses.
Yeah. I think it's, and just to sort of put it in PTA's career arc a bit, it seems like if this is it for Daniel Day-Lewis, if this is sort of the second half of PTA's career, which I think is kind of safe to assume, this movie it sort of gets smaller in scope than some of his other movies. You know, it's a period piece, which, as we've talked about, kind of always seems like things are going to be epic and more grand, but we really don't get that in this sense. And I don't mean this negatively, but there's not a ton of plot here. I mean, you can sum up most things that happen. There's not an incredible amount of dialogue either. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of space for the music. And I just think it's important to talk about how spacious this is and how much room there is for this movie to breathe, and how that allows such intimacy so quickly. You know, mm-hmm. just that the scene where he's ordering from Alma is so instantly and weirdly personal, like, so quickly, even though all that's really being talked about is food. You just get this very intense feeling of connection between the two, and not that they're necessarily meant to be or anything like that, but just that they're both so locked into this. And for that reason, I think that the viewer is too. And when they get back to his house and she's taking his measurements and Cyril walks in, the, I don't know if necessarily awkwardness is the right word, but just you get into Alma's feeling about uncertainty about what's happening. She doesn't know who anyone, who doesn't know who Cyril is, doesn't get an introduction. Mm-hmm. Just the way that this movie so quickly allows personal feelings to come across, I think, is one of its biggest achievements.
Yeah, and I think something that goes hand in hand with that, filmmaking choices that sort of underscore that, is kind of it's not a fast cut movie in any way, like in the sequences where something like what you're describing, you know, it kind of feels like the goal in editing was to hold on every shot for as long as possible until you needed to cut away to tell something essential. And often when you see cuts away to something that's not the face of one of our three leads, is it's a really like tight close-up of, say, the measuring tape that Reynolds is using in that sequence. You know, we've got these just shots of, we're just going to watch Vicky Creeps, who plays Alma, or we're just going to watch Daniel Day-Lewis, who plays Reynolds, and we're going to stick with them until we find this take unusable anymore. And often they will cut from there to an extreme close-up, and it's kind of this jarring sort of style of editing, but jarring in like this very elegant sort of way. It's hard to describe because this movie looks like a 1950s movie, like through and through. They made the most gorgeous movie of 1952 in 2017 somehow, you know. But then the editing style is very, it's just, there's almost no rules to the editing. There's no like, we're doing wide shots and a medium shot and a close-up of this sequence. It's, we're doing what feels right at the time, and we'll just sort of paste it together, or cut it together in a way that makes it feel right in editing. But it's hard to talk about because there's really no, it feels like there's no a really strong idea behind the editing other than just what feels right at the given time. And I think that's an interesting choice and makes the movie really, really move and keeps you engaged. And then the going back to these shots of just hanging on an actor, I don't know, it's just sort of draws you in more to each particular character, and the never cutting away from them gets you closer to their emotion because you get to see more of their facial expressions, even if they're not necessarily saying something. And there's a shot in that sequence where Cyril and Alma are looking at each other, and we're seeing this from Alma's perspective, and Reynolds, who's measuring Alma, steps in front of the camera like and is blocking half of the frame. We see less than half of Cyril's face, and it doesn't cut away for like a number of seconds, you know. And yeah, they just keep talking, and it's and this is something that runs throughout the film. That's just the most obvious example of just this sort of cluttered frame. And it's just, I don't know, it's an interesting decision that I don't really have like a long, I mean, I guess this is kind of long, but a really long explanation as to why that exists. I have a simple explanation for that decision, but I don't know. I think it's just hanging on these shots with characters makes it feel more personal immediately. And also the fact that all three of these people are giving very, very engaging performances.
Yeah. And I think in that scene in particular, I think that it seems like such an intimate moment between Reynolds and Alma. It just seems like this is what, I mean, more Alma than Reynolds will remember this moment or this night of them sort of falling in love. And this is this very elegant personal moment that they share together. And so for a third person to sort of walk in unannounced, Reynolds to not be surprised by it, for very little explanation to be given about, you know, you don't know that's his sister, you don't know if that's his wife, you don't know. It's very confusing for Alma. And so I think just this idea of those shots being sort of blocked and having, you know, bodies in the way, I think just sort of speak to how intrusive this is, that it's supposed to be this very personal moment, and then there's this third sort of unexplained body that gets in the way, and it just throws the nature of what they're doing together into confusion. Mm-hmm. And you don't know what conversation they've had about relationship status or whatever at this mm-hmm. point, or what this is going to mean, if this is a business thing or a friendship thing or a romantic thing. And yeah, a presence of another person in the room and within the shot, I think, does a great job of conveying those personal feelings.
Yeah, that's true. And again, throughout the movie, there are other examples of things standing in the way. And I think you could make an argument that Reynolds' obsession with his work stands in the way of him connecting with other people as well, you know.
Yeah, no
and
doubt.
And his work is creating objects, and objects are usually the things blocking the frame, as opposed to a physical human in that one shot we were talking about.
Right. Yep. Yeah. You mentioned the time period, and it's a 50s movie. And did you read that he was saying, PTA was saying he doesn't want it to look like The Crown?
I did read that. Yeah.
So it's not a, it's an interesting way that they've gone about setting this time period, because they don't really hit you over the head with exactly when this is taking place. You get a sense from the way people dress and some of the settings that it's not 2017. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when I said it, they don't want it to look like The Crown, I think they're just avoiding that super crisp, clean look. But they also don't, I find they also don't go so far to the other end that it's this kind of sepia tone, nostalgic, tons of indicators about when this is taking place. And so, and it doesn't feel as deliberate of a period piece, but the frame, they get away from that clean stuff by sort of dirtying up the frame. I don't know if you want to talk about the time period or maybe how they achieve that look.
Well, it's kind of interesting because I think the cinematography in this movie is very gorgeous, and it's kind of, so something that they definitely wanted to do, talking about not making it look like The Crown, which is a show I've never seen, so I don't have that as a reference point in my head, but they shot it on film, and they wanted to, because again, according to research that I've done, this is not something I know firsthand, the film grains that Kodak stocks that Kodak still makes are very fine grain, because they don't want to make something too dirty. They want it to be closer to digital, because everybody expects a clean look now. So what they did was push a stop, and if you've ever shot like film stills, that basically it increases contrast and makes the actual physical film strip work a little bit harder to get an exposure, and then you do something in developing with it to sort of quote-unquote push it. I'm actually, that's a terrible explanation. Don't ever repeat that in a film class, but you can look it up and find somebody who can explain it better than I can. But what that does is it adds a bit more grain to the film. They also, this is one of the haziest films I've ever seen. There's so much haze going on, like a smoke machine kind of thing. And they just wanted it to look, not clean, because my understanding is the cinematography in The Crown is very clean. And yeah. And I think that ties in with what we've said about framing being cluttered. And I think the other decision that they made, they use a lot of really harsh lighting in this movie. And if you had explained to me how this movie is lit, I'd be like, oh, that's probably not going to look great. And it looks incredible, you know, like just the way that when Barbara Rose is giving her press conference, and it's like the harshest spotlight, because it's a spotlight that would be used to shoot an interview in 1950. Like, it has to be really harsh. Yeah. And that's the most prominent example I can think of. And it just looks gorgeous. And you can see that it's a harsh light, and I don't know, it just works perfectly. It's like this movie often feels like it's lit like a movie from 1950s that's shot in black and white. And a lot of those things in like a noir movie, like this really harsh halo on the back of somebody's head, it looks more natural just because it's black and white and we're kind of used to it. But when you see it in color, it's almost like you see more detail, so you can see that it feels like it makes less sense. It's a less realistic place to put a light, you know, because you think about how the back of people's heads are lit, and you're just like, no, that's not it. It's not like there's a pointed spotlight at the back of people's heads. But I don't know. It's just, it's again, hard to talk about, because I think this is the only movie that looks like this, even including the past couple Paul Thomas Anderson movies. And it's just some of the lighting is so harsh and seems like it shouldn't work and ends up being so gorgeous, you know.
Yeah, and I think this is a movie that's not about glamorizing things, because we're dealing with things that are by nature very glamorous. You know, it's these very expensive dresses that are personalized to these people. You know, these are commissioned for certain events and royalty, and you know, just by the very subject matter of dealing with high-end fashion, we have something that is sort of inherently glamorous. But this film seems to be more interested in highlighting some of the darker, more realistic aspects of what it takes to get there. You know, this is someone who isn't shown to be very happy very often. There's certainly moments of it, but it's even his fame and wealth don't seem to bring him a lot of joy. You know, he's very famous in the fashion world, and you know, when two women approach him at dinner about saying they want to be buried in one of his dresses and that they love his work so much, it's played off as very much an inconvenience to him, which I imagine would be true of Fame. But we don't get a ton of the moments of him reaping the rewards of his work. We just see him struggling with it. We see even him falling in love with Alma. It's played very coldly. As I said, his wedding and his honeymoon don't seem to bring much joy to him. And
I think there are like two attendees at the wedding who are not involved in the actual ceremony.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I think that's part of the hazy look of it, is just about sort of a more realistic look on these things and about someone who is this genius who has this talent, but, you know, it's not really this rock star thing where you've worked really hard and you get to the top of the mountain and then you get to reap the rewards. He just seems to be constantly, constantly suffering for his work and constantly not happy about the way things are, and to the point he can't just enjoy a meal with his, you know, romantic partner and his sister. It's someone's buttering their toast too loudly, or, you know, there's always something that, that prevents him from enjoying his life and enjoying the moment. And we'll talk more about this, I'm sure, but pain seems to be inherent in the way that he functions. You know, he only kind of finds a stride with Alma when he's forced to, you know, be sick and be taken care of. It seems to be the only way he can experience joy is when he's experience affection properly is when it's absolutely needed. And it just, you know, that part of him is very much missing.
Yeah. And I think going back to what you're saying about just sort of this hazy view of history, I think this sort of leads us back to the sort of difficult artist thing that we came up with at the top, where I think I feel like there's a lot of Hitchcock in this movie. I mean,
yeah,
the I mean, it's not very subtle, you know, like Woodcock and Hitchcock, but the, and Anderson loved mentioning Rebecca, which is a movie I have not seen, as a big inspiration on this. And, Hitchcock was famously shitty to, a lot of women, particularly the lead women in his films. And, nobody is viewed as like a more famous singular artist in film by the average person than Alfred Hitchcock, right? Like he's probably the most famous director ever, right? Like and I think you at this point somebody could make an argument for Spielberg probably, but as far as this one filmmaker that everybody knows, it's probably Hitchcock, you know. And
And he was such a celebrity in his own right.
True. Yeah, yeah.
Having his TV show, talking directly to the camera, and having just an even a recognizable silhouette. You know, you're not going to get a Spielberg silhouette that people could pick out.
That's true. That is true. And, you know, just the way that he was talked about and lionized, or is now, certainly. And I thought that was interesting, and doesn't take that much more digging to learn that Alfred Hitchcock's wife was, who was also his editor, is named Alma. You know, like it's, I don't know, it's interesting. And the way that, I think the one that really brought it in is like when Reynolds is measuring Alma for that dress towards the beginning, the first time, after their dinner, where I don't think Reynolds eats, he says to her, "You have no breasts." She says, "I'm sorry." He says, "No, you're perfect. It's my job to give you some if I choose to," so gross. And like that feels like a 1950s line more than any line in this movie. And it also feels like something that somebody who wants to be seen as this sort of singular, difficult artist would say. And Hitchcock seemed to, we're so far from his death and his fame that it's hard to, I mean, we weren't alive, so we don't know how he was talked about in 1960 when Psycho was out, you know, like, but it's, it feels like Hitchcock is somebody who never pushed back on the idea of him being a singular artist in the way that we've talked about Paul Thomas Anderson doing in recent years, you know? And
yeah.
And I think that Alma pushes back is a very important aspect of this movie. Yeah.
Yeah, no, I think it's key. And with the Hitchcock thing, I mean, the mother is a key feature in a lot of Hitchcock.
Oh yeah, and there's psycho shots in this movie. The keyhole shot during the fashion show, where
he's looking through the people.
Yeah, people. Like it's the Bates Motel. But the key aspect of that, and the thing that makes Alma is that in Psycho, Jed at least just being watched, right? And in Phantom Thread, Alma knows he's there, turns, stares directly at him, and it's like, I'm looking back at you. You're not just looking at me. This is a conversation. This isn't you demanding what I do and then I do it, you know? And
yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And once you know, I mean, that takes on even more meaning by the end of the film when you see that she does push back in a certain way. very, very important, dramatic way.
Yes.
And the omelet resistance. Yeah, I'm just always reticent to talk about this, their relationship as romance, because it does seem extremely unhealthy in certain ways, and you don't want to judge people for how they get by, but the level of pain that they put each other through is just so incredible in a certain way. And I mean, even Hitchcock had a quote about shooting love scenes like murder scenes and shooting murder scenes like love scenes. And that's the scene we've talked about of them, I guess, sort of falling in love at the beginning at the dinner. It's you know, I described it as intimate, but it does seem like there is this dangerous element to it too. And, you know, he's getting at something and she's sort of keyed in that all of this is meaning more than just him ordering dinner, but she doesn't know what. And she seems apprehensive. And then, you know, match that with the scene that she's poisoned this omelet near the end. And on paper, you know, this is the scene where she is knowingly poisoning her husband, trying to make him close to deathly ill, but not quite there. That sounds like a very unromantic scene, but the way that it's shot and the things that they end up saying to each other plays off more like a love scene. The nature of those two scenes just brings to mind that Hitchcock quote about shooting love scenes like murder scenes, and it just seems like one more Hitchcock connection in there.
Yeah, for sure. And it's this, I'm sure you remember the music cue that starts when Reynolds eats the omelet towards the end. It's just this very big sweeping music cue that feels more like a grand ball scene than somebody eating an omelet of potential death, you know?
Yeah. Oh, do you want to talk about the music?
Sure. It's constant, you know, yeah. Like I think that's something.
Johnny Greenwood.
Johnny Greenwood, done all the scores for Paul Thomas Anderson since There Will Be Blood. And there's just so much music, and it seems like it never drops out. A lot of times the same music cue carries between scenes that are happening on different days. And it kind of makes the movie almost feel like endless montage. And, when it does drop out, it seems to make everything hit that much harder. Like, I think the main thing that's coming to mind is the when Reynolds gets back from his walk, and again, that he's surprised by Alma, which he doesn't take kindly to. And that's where the music drops out for like 5 to 10 minutes. And it's kind of, I think it's the only part of the movie where that happens. And it makes that sequence that happens at the middle of the film sort of feel even more threatening than it already does, you know?
Yeah.
And I think the main thing that the music does for me in this movie is that idea of linking scenes together with the same music cue. It kind of, that sort of endless montage kind of feel, it really gives the movie, it's hard to grasp how much time passes in this movie. Is it a week? Is it 4 years? Who knows? You know, like, yeah. There is, we know that at some point, December 31st, January 1st happens. Outside of that, I don't. There's no real placing of how much time passes, you know. And
yeah.
And I think the use of music specifically sort of ties into that, you know.
Yeah, and I think that gives it that what you're describing, sort of a dreamlike element to it too, right? You, as you said, the music cues carrying over between big cuts from different scenes and different locations and, you know, likely different days. But as you said, there's no way of knowing.
Yeah, it's, it's like the music is kind of like weaving together, like this movie is one dress, but who knows how long it took to make the dress, you know?
Yeah, and I think I saw that there's 90 minutes of music in this movie.
Okay.
Of score, which yeah. obviously is a majority of this movie, which sounds right in my experience. And yeah, I think that the absence of music at that the scene where she makes dinner for him just makes that scene even more powerful. And it has a lot of power to it just from what's being done. I mean, Alma's been warned against doing it. We have a million examples of Reynolds not liking surprises or liking to do things his exact way, and that this is such a anomalous event to him. And so you know you're going to get in you know, some kind of disagreement, and the fact that it just is allowed to play out the way that it does just gives that much more weight to the performances.
Yeah, exactly. And I think the scenes where the music drops out are pretty much always scenes where characters are at a dinner table, breakfast table, something along those lines. And it's those conversations that are the most, I think, memorable in the movie. Those are some of the most memorable scenes. And I think it's specifically because they're the ones that are the fullest as far as like the longest. And again, the dropping out of the music makes them stand apart from the rest of the movie, you know?
Yeah, and I think that just the role of food in this movie is very important. And we talked about a bit of the mother angle with Hitchcock there. And his mother is sort of, Woodcock's mother is sort of this, you know, specter that's over this entire film. And it gets brought up a few times in some very meaningful scenes when he's talking to her or when he thinks he's about to die and sort of hallucinating and speaking to that empty chair. Mm-hmm. And as we said, it's just kind of one of the few things that we see people do that's not directly related to making dresses or selling dresses or showing dresses to try to sell them or taking measurements to make a dress. You know, it's this very essential thing. And to look at it through this idea of the maternal character as well. He wants to be fed and he wants to be taken care of. And, you know, he kind of seems to enjoy being infantilized. He has this extreme desire to have control in most things. And it seems that the only way for him to function and to cede any amount of control is to completely revert back to childhood. And I think it's important that when he falls in love with Alma, he's being fed, and it's important for him to not just feel like another customer. And that's why he takes her notebook and wants to see if he's instantly important enough to her for her to remember this extremely long and complicated order. And food continues to play a big role throughout this movie, and it's you know, that's the way the poison is given to him. That's you know, to see him function with other people is when they go out to dinner. You know, it's this one thing that's weaved throughout this entire story. And it's, you know, it's the only thing that's not dressmaking that gets any amount of time in this movie. So, of course, it's very meaningful.
Yeah, yeah. No, I agree. And I think the going back to him taking the breakfast order from Alma after, you know, giving her the breakfast order and then taking her the piece of paper that she wrote it on and saying, I'm keeping this. In that she, when she comes back with the breakfast and he asks her to dinner, that she already has a note written out for him, I think is an important aspect of her character. Like, she's not like an entirely submissive person. She was already preparing to do, to step out and say something to him, right? Like, in a different sort of way. And
yeah.
When he picks her up for that dinner, she steps toward the car, before he opens the door for her. Like, she doesn't need him to open the door for her. She'll happily do it herself. You know, he's going to use this old-fashioned chivalry, or I guess at the time just chivalry, and but she doesn't need it, and she's able to do these things on her own. And again, that scene that we've already talked about after dinner and hanging out at the fire, when he's measuring Alma for the dress, when he gives her shit for standing differently from how she stood 5 seconds before, that she argues with him, that she immediately argues with him, I think is very important aspect of her character. And she never becomes a somebody who's entirely submissive. And I mean, neither does Cyril. These are the two women that are able to stay in his life because of the two people who call him on his shit. You know, like, I think one of the most memorable scenes in this movie is when Cyril tells him, "Don't start a fight with me, I'll run you over," or whatever she says.
Let's go right through you.
Oh, it's incredible. I love
it. Yeah, it's fantastic.
And the only way to tolerate yourself while being around somebody like Reynolds is to push back. And the only way that somebody like that can really love you is if you call him on the stuff. And I think something that this movie does a really good job of is saying that somebody who's treated like this will continue to play into it, will continue to be fed every morning and protected in the way that Cyril protects them. But what they really want is somebody to call them on their shit, you know? And I think that's an interesting thing that this movie gets across in a very, in a way that doesn't hit you over the head with it, you know?
Yeah. And I think it's important. I mean, that, even in that first scene at the restaurant where Alma's working, she calls him her hungry boy. Mm-hmm. I mean, that is such a maternal thing, phrase yep. that exists. Mm-hmm. And my understanding is that Alma can mean nurturing one, just to kind of fit her in with the maternal character again. And then at the on their honeymoon, as you said, you know, she kind of, it's all about her pushing back. And I think that obviously 99.999% of people that have pushed back on Reynolds' demands in his lifetime, he quickly cancels out and yeah. has no use for her ever again. And we see in kind of one of the biggest moments of this movie is that he does cede control. And when she wants to go to the New Year's Eve party and he doesn't, you know, he's trying to assert his dominance and say, "We're going to do things my way all the time." And, you know, they're very freshly married, and it's already coming up to this very important separation between him having 100% control and her sort of just having to submit to it. Mm-hmm. And she goes to the ball, and, you know, this notion of order versus chaos and him being this person that, you know, this godlike figure that gets to control every aspect of his business, their marriage, Alma's life, the way she looks and dresses, all these things. He goes to what appears to be the most chaotic place on the planet at that moment. Like that, which the scene is wild to look at.
Yeah.
But it's absolute madness, and just the costumes, the gigantic hats, and women running around in like gorilla masks. And you don't know if people are fighting or just bumping into each other or if they're dancing. And, you know, we see her in a shot with another man, that he leaves this place, you know, at the, I guess, resort where he's very respected and it's very quiet and calm. And they're playing a very orderly game of backgammon, that she goes to this place that is visually and orally and, you know, just chaotic in every sense, that he is willing to go into that spot and, you know, wade through that chaos in order to get to her and show that she's still important to him, says a lot. And I still just struggle talking about this relationship because in so many ways he's so awful and so abusive that it's hard for me to fully just give over to, oh, you know, whatever works for people, that's what love is. you know, because it's so heavy and so gross in so many ways, but yeah. And we'll talk about it more at the end, I'm sure. But yeah. Just the stride that they find that we're left with. The seed's planted very early. You know, she says to the doctor, or who we later figure out is the doctor, you know, she says, he might be the most difficult man on the planet. I just have to give every piece of myself to him. It's all very, very uncomfortable.
And yeah.
I can't get past it.
Yeah. I mean, the vast majority of this movie is very uncomfortable, you know? And it's almost like you get used to the mild discomfort in between the more aggressive discomfort that comes in certain yeah. sequences. But what you were saying about the New Year's party, I think we'll talk about exaggeration a little bit. And that feels like, because the way you see Reynolds enter that party, he enters through like this almost this balcony sort of thing, like an upper level that he's walking around, and he's still like he's at the place where the party is happening, but he's looking down on the floor where everybody is, and yeah. he's not immediately entering it. He's still an outsider even inside this this party. And that whole thing, like you said, it's so over the top, and it feels like it feels exaggerated in the way that somebody doesn't want to go to a party would remember how that party was yeah, when they ended up
even
there.
If there were 10 people there.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. There were 10 people there, and one person was wearing a cowboy hat. Ipso facto, hundreds of people wearing the most extravagant paper mache costumes that make no sense whatsoever. And I think that's something that's worth noting, is that he's out of his comfort element, and as such, he feels even more aggressively outside of it, you know?
Yeah, and it's still a beautiful sequence. And
oh, it's an incredible sequence.
We've talked about how much music is in this movie, and I think some of it sounds so good. Like, I think this is such, there's so much beautiful music in mm-hmm. this, and the piano and violin stuff is just so incredible. And because there are moments like this where there's little to no dialogue, and you really get to kind of take it all in, and the way that the phrases connect these different moments. Yeah, that dreamlike effect is not as easy to get lost in if the music isn't good enough. And I think this music is more than good enough.
Yeah, for sure. And I think touching on what you're saying about music, like, it feels like a very classical score, but there's something about it that feels incredibly modern. I've always kind of felt the way that specifically the way I forget which it's when they're, I think it's when they're making the, fixing the dress that Reynolds ruins when he passes out, gets yeah. the shoe polish on and rips it. That music cue, it's primarily a piano cue, but it's so like slightly bizarre. And I think a big part of it has to do with, and again, I don't know a lot about music, but, it feels like the way that Johnny Greenwood mics these pianos is just so different. Like, you can hear the key, the physical key, not the key playing the note, but you can hear the key actually move, the piano key move outside of the sound that the piano is making. And it's this slightly off-kilter thing. You can hear it in a lot of Radiohead songs that are piano-based as well. And it feels like there's a second piano playing a slightly off time. And I don't know, I think the movie, the music in this movie very subtly in pieces of music that often seem more simplistic compared to the bigger, grander orchestral moments, it still feels slightly off kilter without you necessarily knowing that it's off kilter. And I think that kind of sums up the feeling of this movie, is that from the outside, it looks like a standard kind of romance, but on the inside, it's actually incredibly off-kilter and bizarre, and you never quite know how to feel about it the whole thing, even after you're finished watching it, you know?
Yeah, and the sound of the piano you're describing, I mean, I think it's the mechanism of a piano is you push down a certain key, and then that articulates a hammer to move and hit a string, and that's when you think of a piano being played. You think of those strings being hit by the hammers, mm-hmm. but it's the physical work of somebody playing the piano, that key being pushed down, you know, that ivory maybe hitting the wood of the piano's frame. And that's the work that Reynolds does. And that's mm-hmm. the work of you know, that Cyril and all the women who actually do the sewing do. And this movie is about that part of it, and about the part of the relationship that's behind closed doors. And it's not just the final product, you know, the hammer hitting the string, this completed dress on the model, but the work that goes into the sketching and the measuring and all those things that, you know, the dress side of the piano key being struck, and not just the string itself.
Mm-hmm. Should we talk about Reynolds's mother?
Yeah, sure.
So, I mean, I think this is a part of the movie that feels pretty like easy. And I think that's why, like, easy to talk about. And, I think that's why I suspect that I'm wrong about everything I think about it. in that, you know, Cyril sort of acts as a replacement of his mother. And she's somebody who, takes care of him in the absence of his mother has passed away. And then Alma comes along and not necessarily replaces Cyril, but sort of takes her top spot, if you will, on the Reynolds Woodcock power rankings of most important women in his life. But I think it's notable to point out that there's a point early in Alma and Reynolds' relationship where she knocks on the door while he's working at night and asks him if he wants anything. And he says, no, thank you. And then cut to Cyril coming up the stairs with tea. And she doesn't even knock. She just walks in the door and brings Reynolds the tea, you know. And contrast that with the later in the film when Reynolds is sick at the House of Woodcock, the first time he gets really ill by way of poisoning. Alma and Cyril go to leave the room together, and Alma just closes the door on Cyril. And that is also the same scene where, or shortly thereafter, Reynolds sees the ghost of his mother and is talking to her, and Alma enters the room again, come back to check on him. And she crosses the room and cut to a close-up of Reynolds, and we cut back to the shot that the mother figure was in previously, and now she's gone. Now it's just Alma. And it's like almost a maternal replacement both for his mother and for Cyril, you know?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And
no, I think that's right.
Right? That seems pretty straightforward.
Yeah.
But the other thing that I think is worth talking about, and this is something that I have less, you know, like put together thoughts about, is the idea of like time and ghosts that runs throughout this movie. And I think something that's worth noting while we're still talking about the mothers is there's a door. Remember when Barbara Rose shows up to the house and Cyril lets her in? And on her way there, she closes the basement door that is just sort of like fallen open, kind of. It's like slowly opening by itself. And
yeah.
That's the door that the seamstress is used to get in and out every day. It's the back entrance, essentially. And it feels like, and right after that sequence, after they make that dress, they go out to dinner, and that's when Reynolds starts talking about his mother. And it's kind of like, that's like a door that their mother has walked back through, and Cyril is just sort of, trying to, maintain the order that was there. And, but the ghost has entered the house. And I just thought that was a really interesting thing that realistically was probably an accident on set, and Leslie Manville just went with it. And I think the juxtaposition of that right before a scene where Reynolds starts talking about how he has started seeing his mother in his dreams is notable.
Yeah, and the idea that the door moving on its own, and the fact that Reynolds has a reaction to this sort of thing that is so converse to what I think a typical person would think. You know, even just the idea that when he talks about the ghosts, that he doesn't find it spooky. He thinks it's comforting that maybe his mother's still around and looking over him. Mm-hmm. It's such an inversion of the way that most people would talk about these kinds of things, and that, you know, maybe the door moving is representative of this other spirit being in the house, but he doesn't feel like that's a bad thing. And the sickness that nearly killed him brings him closer to his mother in, you know, two ways, that maybe he's closer to seeing her in the afterlife, and that it makes her presence more concrete in his life. And he seems like someone that that's more present than it is for some people, even with deceased parents that they loved very much. But the way that he, you know, literally sows things to remind him of his mother near to his heart, and is thinking about her and even directly speaking with her and eventually seeing her in a way, is so important to him. And as I said, with the way he infantilizes himself, the way that he makes him feel like a child again is another way for him to feel closer to his mother, to get to that spot in his life where he was being cared for at that level, allows him to feel her presence more.
Yeah, for sure. And also that's, you know, ghosts get mentioned a handful of times in this movie, yeah. Even apart from the mother, like Cyril, we talked about that breakfast that ends with Cyril basically threatening Reynolds. You know, she asks, that conversation starts with her asking if Reynolds wants her to get rid of Alma in the same manner that she did Joanna earlier at the beginning of the movie. And Cyril says to her, if you're going to make her a ghost, do it. Don't make her sit around. I'm very fond of her. And, yeah. You know, one of the last things discussed in this movie is ghosts get mentioned, you know? And I just think it's an interesting, again, tying to the theme of time that we've talked about and not really come down on anything about its meaning. It's just sort of like this movie is somehow taking place constantly and never, you know, like it's I don't know, it's just another thing that's just there always and you never quite know when it is, you know.
Yeah, and the part of this, you know, I think it is 2 years or something, but it's irrelevant, like mm-hmm. what we see in this movie. And we've talked about the music and the cutting contributing to that notion, and I think that also is supposed to be about Reynolds and eventually Alma's concern that death isn't really the end of things, that things aren't going to end when Reynolds dies or when she dies, that the way that time is played with during this, you know, empirical amount of time, you know, these 2 years, whatever it is, that it just kind of weaves in and out, and you get the sense that the story is told in a straightforward fashion, you know, that the events fall in order that we see them in this film, but that it doesn't really matter, and that you know, the way that the ghost of his mother is still around during his life and that death didn't really separate them. And I think that we're supposed to understand that life and death aren't really essential to him, that they don't really mean anything. And that Alma even says, if he didn't wake up from this, if he wasn't here tomorrow, no matter, for I'd know he'd be waiting for me in the afterlife or some safe celestial place in this life and the next and the one after. Mm-hmm. And for whatever there is on the road that follows here, it would only require my patience to get to him again. See, and so it just seems like that they don't feel like death is going to separate them, and that time is meaningless within this lifetime, essentially, because time is kind of always meaningless to them, that they're these two, that they're these creatures that Reynolds and his mother and Alma and presumably Cyril aren't really harnessed by this thing. And I think that's why we get these music cues and these cuts and this other filmmaking language that really reduces the meaning of time, because they don't feel constrained by it.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a good point. And I think we'll come back to the Alma voiceover in a minute, but the something that you're talking about, how they don't feel constrained by time and the way that the camera moves, I think, in a key moment in this movie. Well, early on when Reynolds is telling the story about the dress that he made for the wedding dress he made for his mother when he was 16, the camera's, we're in a two shot basically, and the camera's slowly pushing in on the two. And this is not genius film language by any means. It's pretty straightforward. It's just, we're moving closer towards them as they get to know each other a little bit. Like Reynolds, that's a pretty like personal revelation, or sorry, personal story for Reynolds to be telling somebody at all, let alone this early in them knowing each other. You know, like there's not a lot in this movie to indicate Reynolds telling an emotional story from his past to anybody, you know, and this is the I think the only time it happens to somebody who's not Cyril, when they're just both remembering their mother. And later in the movie, after Reynolds recovers from that, the first poisoning, when he wakes up and almost asleep on the couch, we start the shot with, there's a stool very prominently in the foreground out of focus, some other elements that are would be involved in work, and there's a dress slightly forward from the couch and on the left side. And the camera very slowly pushes in, and there's no edits in the sequence. It's just the two of them. It's when Reynolds proposes to Alma. And basically, from the, if you look at the first frame of that shot to the last frame of that shot, the first frame is incredibly cluttered. But by the end of the frame, the camera has moved in. I think it might even be a move with a slight zoom. And has moved in, and now the only thing in the frame is Alma and... Alma and Reynolds, as they have their conversation and agree to marry each other. And I think that's an interesting or a notable aspect of their relationship, is that the camera physically pushes past these icons of his own work, you know, to just be the two of them in the end of the frame. And that it's such an emotional moment for them is key as well. You know?
Yeah, no, it's this movie is so much about his work and how he can't really extradite himself from it. So any moment where not only is work not mentioned, but we see it, you know, we literally move past it to get to just them, I think is of extreme importance.
Yeah, for sure. And I guess the going back to the time and ghosts and just in general, the voiceover, or I guess I have a question before we get there. What is Alma's backstory? Where is Alma before we meet her? What is her life?
I think that she is a German citizen who is no longer in Germany and is working as a waitress and maybe does not have that many people close around her.
Okay.
That's all I can. I mean, we we don't get a lot. I can imagine Reynolds maybe didn't ask her too much about her life before him, to be quite honest.
Like Reynolds.
Yeah, to be quite honest with you. Yeah. And he's a very handsome and rich and famous and intelligent man. Yeah. And I mean, I can go over the things that are awful about him again, but I think that she...
I think we've done an hour on how he's awful, and you just have 5 seconds on why he's appealing.
Yeah, I think she's I think she's attracted to him and his lifestyle.
Okay. The reason I ask is because... I did hear Paul Thomas Anderson talking in an interview about how there was one scene that explained Alma's backstory that was cut, and he just sort of uses this offhand throwaway comment about how the scene, the Barbara Rose press conference about the press conference interview, whatever it is, about her upcoming wedding, that the line about visas was key, and that they chose to show a close-up of Alma during that, and that is her backstory. And
I was just like,
you know more about wartime history than I do, so I figured I'd throw that one at you. Cool, that's I was just curious. I think we're kind of on the same page, but and going to the again back to ghosts and time. What's her relationship with the doctor that she's talking to this whole time? Like,
yeah, I don't know. I think, I don't know how many people in her life she ever gets to talk about Reynolds with. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that she can't talk to his employees maybe as frankly as she would like. And, obviously Cyril is not a, completely uninterested party when it comes to that. Mm-hmm. I think it's someone around her age who she has a chance to speak with and doesn't have a lot of sort of neutral, I don't even want to say friends, but even acquaintances that she has any chance to speak with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay. That because again, I don't have like a solid thought on this. I just think it's notable that in all of the moments where we get Alma's voiceover, it seems like she's talking to that doctor character. I think his name's Dr. Hattie. But until the very end, when we get that last sort of voiceover bit, that ends with Reynolds speaking, saying, "And I'm getting hungry." And it's the way that that piece of voiceover begins, we would assume she's talking to the doctor because that's the way that the movie has set up these scenes to this point. But this is the reveal of that, the ending of that is that she's talking to Reynolds. And it's almost like it kind of reframes the conversations with the doctor from earlier to be like almost as though she's talking to an ex about her new partner, you know? And
yeah.
And I think that follows with how Reynolds treats the doctor. Like, it doesn't, I'm not saying that they had met before and had some sort of romantic interest, Alma and the doctor, but because the movie makes it pretty clear that they have not met. But I just thought it was interesting, and with all the talk of ghosts and time and all of these things, that we get a repeated style of scene with this one character, and just at the end, it's like, nope, you're with Reynolds now. This is Reynolds, you know?
Yeah.
I don't know. And again, it's not like a fully formed take or anything. It's just, I don't know, something that I thought about and had no answer for.
You're going to have to ask Alma.
Okay, I'll call up Vicky Creeps after this podcast, and I'll get to the bottom of this. The other thing that I think we haven't really talked about how funny this movie is, and it doesn't need pointing out, but the things that I think are funny and simultaneously meaningful are when certain situations where it's usually Alma, where the sounds, so the morning when they have breakfast together, this is the morning after they've slept together seemingly for the first time, the way that she's scraping her toast, just the sound of her getting a piece of butter to put on that toast, the teapot, all of these things, it's just
so deeply loud.
Oh, and it's like they're cranking the sound for sure. And
oh,
it's
no,
like,
there's no sense of realism. This is Reynolds just being so particular about things. Now, the way she pours her tea, and later the way she pours her water in a way that she moves a light fixture.
No, I'm getting to that. Like, this is something that, like, annoys him immediately, and to the point where he says, it's like you rode a horse across the room. Which is so, so incredibly mean to say. You know, there's something similar happens the day after, or seemingly the day after they get married. Maybe it's 6 weeks after. Who knows with this movie? But when they're eating breakfast, she's like scraping her teeth on the spoon again in a way that in no way helps her consume her food. Like, this can't possibly be real. And Reynolds, like, we get this amazing shot of Reynolds just exhaling deeply. He's just like, well, I'm stuck with this now. You know, like, And again, going back to that moment that you mentioned, her pouring the water at the very end, in the first meeting when she pours his tea and they're at the breakfast, when, you know, they first met, she does a little bit like that when she pours the tea and puts it down. Doesn't bother him at all. It's not weird at all. It's just a thing that happens. You know, if anything, it's slightly endearing to him. And then she pours this water at the end, and it's so exaggerated. She's moving the light, as you said, and it's just like, she's not pouring water like that. That's not a real thing. That's just something that, it's like when you know somebody and you're like, this person's going to be in my life for a long time. Everybody has something that annoys them about you. And there's just no perfect human being. And there are certain things that you just have to tolerate. And it's eating loudly. And that's the thing that Reynolds has to tolerate. Whereas Alma has to tolerate all of Reynolds' other bullshit, you know, and it's just like
he's a monster.
Yeah, exactly. The contrast with Alma eats a little bit loudly, and Reynolds is a physical nightmare human being, you know, like, so I think that's worth pointing out. It's something that seems so intolerable to Reynolds is just like, you know, the bottom rung of things that would bother Alma about Reynolds, you know.
Yeah, and another bit of food-related dialogue that I think is great, but also is kind of easy to overlook as being just for a laugh, is when she tries to bring him the tea and then ends up, you know, taking it away. And he says, the tea is going out. The interruption is staying right here with me.
Yeah.
So first of all, just a wonderful line.
Oh, and I think about that line constantly.
Yeah. Cause it's funny. It fleshes out this character and that relationship. It seems timely. Obviously I wasn't around in 1951 or whatever this is, but that does kind of seem like that, you know, verbose way that somebody might speak then. Mm-hmm. And, you know, doesn't just flesh out that character, as I said, in the sense that, you know, he's particular and he's very rude sometimes even when people are trying to help him out. But it's about things staying around. And mm-hmm. it's another food and drink thing that we've, you know, already explained why that's so important to this movie. But it's like his mother. It's like the ghost. It's like everything that meant something to him, positive or negatively, and then when it's gone, when it's over, it's not over for him. You know, there's the, you know, the interruption stays with me. The thing that bugged me is really no longer here, but I can't get past it.
Yeah.
And this movie is, in a way, a lot about him not being able to get past things and in history continuing to mean a lot and shape the way he is and the way he acts, and for better or worse, that's just part of his personality.
Yeah. Okay, so Reynolds Woodcock, definite good human being, is sort of where we're settling on this.
Yeah, that's what I'm
perfect,
trying to get
flawless
across, right?
Representation of humanity. Great.
Yeah.
So thanks for listening to the MacGuffin, man, and be sure to check back next time.